It's a really valuable skill that I've learned from designing is just like how to respond to feedback, how to think about an audience. It's like kind of goes to what you were saying about Amazon people and like some people trashing the book, but it's not for them. And it's thinking about, okay, who's my target audience, right? Because not everyone's going to like every design that I do either, but you have to think about your target audience. Otherwise, like you're just creating this like very vanilla piece of work.
Hello and welcome to Creativity for Sale podcast, a show to help you start and grow your life-changing creative career and business. My name is Radim Malinich and creativity changed my life. You see, I believe creativity can change your life too. I even wrote a book about it and it inspired this podcast. I've set out to interview the world's most brilliant creatives, designers, writers, musicians, makers, and marketeers about their life-changing experiences with creativity. If you ever wanted to know how people go from their humble beginnings to the pinnacle of their success, our conversation should provide you with an intimate look into triumphs, challenges, and untold stories behind their creative endeavors. We also discuss the highs and lows of creative careers and creative life. So, thank you for joining me on this exploration of passion, creativity, innovation, and the boundless potential within us all. Let creativity change your life. Are you ready? My guest today is an author, educator, and creative director specializing in branding and editorial design. Currently, he's the creative director of Fast Company, a monthly magazine focused on technology, business, and design. He guides a team of art directors and photo editors who create visuals for all expressions of the Fast Company brand. His recent debut book title, Creative Endurance, is a practical guide for staying motivated and achieving your goals. It's my pleasure to introduce Mike Schneid. Hi, Mike. Welcome to the show. I want to congratulate you on your recent accomplishment of releasing your book called Creative Endurance. And I would like to use the word endurance as a topic of our conversation because I want to talk about how we got into publishing, how we got into what you do for a living, all sorts of stuff. So if you were to take us back, tell us what you do now and what's your sort of story? How did you get to it?
Sure. I'm the creative director of Fast Company. I've been there for about 5.5 years. There I oversee the magazine, the website. We do a series of events. We do award programs, social media campaign, all sorts of other branding projects as well. So kind of a cross between editorial design and branding. I've worked in publishing for 20 years now. I'm actually coming up on my 20-year mark. Worked everywhere from Men's Health to Esquire to Popular Science, Entertainment Weekly. And I think I found that like when I was coming close to my 20-year mark, I started to think a little bit more about what I wanted to do with design. I think that a lot of us got into this field because we like making things. I think that's a commonality between most creative people. And I, like as a kid, I loved making comics and that kind of transitioned me into liking to make magazines because it was like printed material and the closest thing to making comics, right? But I would say 15, 16 years in to working in publishing, pandemic hit and we saw like creatives were thinking a little bit differently about work and we were a little bit more transparent and open about our problems. So I think from that, I had the idea that I wanted to create some kind of a book that could help people. Right. I never thought of myself. I always wanted to write a book. You know, writing was always kind of a little bit of a side interest of mine. Never thought of myself as like a fiction writer. I always felt like I needed some kind of like function and purpose for writing. So one thing led to another. And I had this idea to write a book and use what I've learned through editorial design to make a book that felt very servicey for the reader. A book that felt like there was some kind of takeaway on every single page. A book that felt like a creative coach sitting by your side and just giving you a pat on the back and reassuring you and just giving you a little bit of advice. And that's really what led me to write Creative Endurance.
Amazing. I've written two things. One of them was comics. And I really want to go to that early stage. When did you discover? Where did you live? What age? Because yeah, comics, they never really crossed my path, but I'm always fascinated when people say comics were something that they took up and used it as a sort of starting block. So where did comics come from?
I mean, I'm an only child, so I spent a lot of time just sitting alone and just like, it sounds sad, but it was really a lot of fun just to sit around and just draw. And I loved reading like Marvel comics, like X-Men and Punisher. And I was like a typical like guy in the 1980s, like reading stuff like that. You know, from when I was a young kid, I loved taking like 8.5 by 11 sheets of paper, folding them in half, cutting them and stapling them into little mini comics. And I would like draw the cover, and it was usually some kind of copy off of like Wolverine or Cyclops or something like that. I'd draw the cover, and then I would just basically draw the inside. The cover was like my way of me holding myself accountable to like finish the comic. But I wasn't like the best at drawing, but I loved coming up with ideas. Like I was just like loved just the art of like, it was like nonstop ideas. Like I wanted to like, as soon as I drew the cover, I'm like, I want to finish this comic so I can move on to the next comic. So I would kind of like just speed through. And a lot of what I learned was from like copying. And my mom would give me $10 to go buy two comics at the store. And that was like my weekly allowance or whatever. And I would just copy comics. And then, you know, it was funny because years and years later, when I was in college, it was like I found like I was doing it. The pattern was repeating again, but it was with magazines. And I was just like going to the newsstands. And like, I would go to Tower Records, which is like a music store here in the US. And like early 2000s, it was like the magazine racks were just like wall to wall, tons and tons of magazines. And I would just go and just buy up all the magazines I could and bring them home. And I kept magazines in milk crates. And I found myself then just like copying art directors instead of comics. So that was like my education when I was in college. It was like my second education from like whatever my professors taught me was like just emulating magazines and always just dreaming like, hey, these magazines have like cool celebrities on them. And magazines like Entertainment Weekly, like they look like comics. As far as I was concerned, at that age when I was still learning the typography and everything was just like, it was so exciting and so energetic. I was like, oh, this feels like the right thing for me.
I love the parallel. And I think what you named your book, Creative Endurance, it almost seems like you were always destined to write a book, Creative Endurance, because to hold yourself accountable at such a young age, like I'm going to finish this comic, maybe from experience from mine, and I see my kids, like how they operate with creativity, and they kind of give it a start, but they're like, what's next? Maybe they're like too much of a sort of multidimensional absorbers, but I love that you kind of decided that you're going to finish it and kind of hold yourself accountable, which I think is fantastic.
Yeah, I was very focused as a kid.
That's amazing. I think that's where you are exactly where you are today. But I can only sort of echo your point about the magazines in the year 2000s and, you know, in the early 2000s. I don't think we'll ever experience this ever again. I mean, there's still tons and tons of magazines. Obviously, you're working on one of them. But I think there was something in the air. Like I've always said, like being a teenager in the 90s was the best thing on the planet ever. We'll never repeat that. And the publishing around the time, especially the early 2000s with the arrival of the internet and distribution, I think was really exciting.
It was so exciting. And I like remember back then like seeing Fast Company, because Fast Company came out in 1995. And then this was like 2001, 2002, when Patrick Mitchell was the creative director. And they were one of the few business magazines out there that were doing like type covers. And like they would do just these really bold type covers, like some kind of crazy like neon orange Pantone color printed on top of like a gray background. And those caught my eye. And I mean, I can't say that back then I was like, oh, I'm going to one day be the creative director of Fast Company. Like it's, you know, there's definitely not like any destiny happening there. But I do remember that was an early moment where I was like, oh, it kind of like made my heart sing a little bit. And I think it kind of makes sense to why like years and years later, like I've fallen in love with writing too, is like typography, like seeing the visual part of it was like my gateway drug into it. And then throughout my years of working in magazines, like as an art director, we work side by side with editors. So we're collaborators and we wear each other's hats sometimes, because in any kind of collaborative project, as a designer, you have to think a little bit like an editor and you have to allow the editor to think like you. So there's a little bit of like, okay, I have to let go of my ego here and not think that like I'm fully in control of design. But like through that, there's a trade-off where the editor will allow you to think a little bit like them too, because together we're creating stories, right? We're storytellers. So throughout those years of working with editors and writers, it's like, while I wasn't necessarily like coming up with the stories, I was absorbing, I was like a sponge, just like paying attention to how they came up with their stories. Because like, I'm kind of a quiet person when I'm not babbling on like this. And when I'm not talking, I try to really listen and be present. Sometimes it might look like I'm just drifting off. Like I'm fully there, and I was always fully there, just processing each draft that would come in of a piece of writing and thinking about, okay, how did it change? What is this editor thinking about? So when it came time to like produce this book and think about the structure of the book and think about how do I make this an entertaining read for my audience? It all felt like, oh yeah, okay. Like while it was daunting, I was like, okay, I feel like I got this.
It's incredible. Did you pitch the project or did you get approached to write a book? How did it come about? Because you mentioned that sort of the pandemic hit and we decided to sort of be looked into different ways of working. And I like that you said that it was still like it's meant to be the book meant to be a sort of creative coach, like something that you learned from it. How did the concept come about and how did the book come about itself?
So I started teaching in the beginning of the pandemic or in September 2020. So I think that by teaching design, that's when it started to kind of really spark this desire to want to find some kind of greater purpose. I really enjoyed teaching the students and helping them and enjoyed like learning about a totally new generation and seeing what they were going through. And that started to make me think more and more about, okay, I feel like people need some kind of coach, need some kind of guide. A few years into teaching, when we were finally back in person, I started teaching at this school, Kane University. It's in Jersey, about 20 minutes away from where I live in Jersey City. And it was my first semester teaching there. They asked me to give a presentation on myself. And, you know, they were just kind of like, as many people do when they say give a presentation, they're just like, yeah, show some of your work. And like, I don't love just showing some of my work. Like I like telling a story. And I thought, let me challenge myself and tell a story that talks about the parallels of my career as a designer to the parallels of my hobby as a runner and how the two have fueled each other. Because I'm a daily runner. So every morning I get up and I run 3 to 6 miles. And I think maybe in my 20s, it was like, oh, I want to run so I could just eat a burger every day and have a beer. But like, then it became much more of a mental thing and just provided clarity throughout my day. And I thought there's something to this. And also throughout my career as a designer and a runner, like I've grown as a runner. So I've grown from like a guy who like just runs a couple miles a day to somebody who's run 3 marathons. And that worked on the same track as me growing as from a designer to a creative director. So anyway, I gave this presentation and then afterwards, a professor I'd never met before came up to me and she said, Mike, you've got a book idea on your hands. She said, there's like the whole like Nike, just do it crowd. And I think you should try to pitch a book. So with her help, her name was Robin Land. I owe her a lot of credit because she saw something in me that I didn't see in myself. But when somebody says like, hey, write a book or you should write a book, like you can't ignore that, especially when the thought's been kicking around in your head. And I was like so excited that she saw some potential in me. I didn't even think about, oh, this is going to be really freaking hard to do. I'm just going to go for it. So yeah, I just put together a proposal with her help. I pitched it to like probably 20-something publishers. I got a lot of rejection letters because the initial idea was this book called The Runner's Guide to Design. So it was very specific. And because I thought it would be funny. Like I thought nobody's written a book like this before. And if you like running or design, it'll appeal to you. And I did pull up a lot of stats about runners in the world, but people didn't buy it. But then my publisher, Rockport, long story short, they saw the proposal. We talked about it and they said, this is a good idea, but it's not your first book. This feels like it could be your second book. And that was like, okay, now they really see something in me. They feel like this could be my second book. And I shaped it into something that felt more universal. And that's what became Creative Endurance. And through that, I became, you know, it was really a satisfying process because it helped me kind of grow out of like, okay, let me write this book for myself and let me write this book for everybody else. So it started as maybe a little bit like a memoir and then like it grew into much more than that.
That's an amazing story, Mike. In my talks, I've got a section where I talk about 3 superheroes and the 3 superheroes that used to run past my old house. That we're running every day, mud, winter, snow, everything. And I always ask in the audience, which is mainly designers, who's a runner? And you know what? I think out of about 500, 600 people so far, about 5 hands got up. And you're thinking, like, how is it that I know so many runners? So many of my friends are runners, designers are runners there, you know? And my friend Mark McKee from New York, from Creative Factor, like he's an amazing runner, like, I know so many designers who are endurance athletes, but we are older because when I was in my early 20s, I didn't bother. You know, I used to be almost professional ice hockey player and I only got into ice hockey because I hated running at that time. I didn't have that patience, you know, that I'm in my mid 40s now and the patience is plentiful. You know, I'm a daily cyclist and I do these sort of 100 mile
cycles, no problem now. It's just you have to be more prepared to ache, to hurt, to actually put endurance in. You know, actually, you have to be ready for the fact that it's not going to be easy. And I think that's a testament for like mid-career points where you realize, you know what? It was hard work to get to this point. Put on your shoes every day and run just because of that burger and that beer that you want to burn off. And that's pretty much half of the reason that you can never outrun a bad diet or outcycle a bad diet. And I've tried that. It doesn't work. And I like that. I think what I'm still getting from this conversation is this endurance that you're grateful for someone to finding that little nugget. And you want to do that same thing with your teaching, which obviously you want to give something back. Because I very much agree with the fact that you're writing a book for yourself at first. And you want to remind yourself almost of the checkpoints that you've got to, like how far you got there. Because I never understood that when musicians said, look, we made a record for ourselves. I'm thinking, well, you want to sell it, right? You want to get it to other people. And then you realize, what? There'll be people who will connect with it, people who will hate it. You might convert them later. And some people who actually liked it might go, you know what, actually, there was nothing in it for me. Actually, I had time to spend with it. And what always confuses me with the book pitch is that you try to get someone like a full experience through just a few pages of paper. Like, I mean, I've never had to pitch because, you know, my story is different, but it's just like, how do you break into it? And it kind of almost seems like a link with the magazines where you give people as much information as you can, as you give page allowance and that kind of stuff. With the runner's philosophy, is that going to be a second book?
I'm thinking a little bit, I would love to write a book more about like careers and demystify creative success. Because I think since I've started teaching, I think a lot about the younger generation and how they like, you know, when we have guest speakers come to the class and like, they're like, their first question is just like, how did you get here? Right. And they have no idea how they got there. Right. So I think that a book on creative success like speaks to a younger generation, but also nobody like works the same industry for their entire career now. Like we want to constantly like evolve and grow. And I think even as me as an example, like I'm morphing into a designer. I already am a designer, a writer, but you know, like we all want to grow to some degree and think about how can we continue to change. So I think that a book on that kind of demystifies a creative career could be valuable for people. And I really loved, part of writing Creative Endurance, one thing I loved was like talking to so many types of people. And I didn't think that going into it, and certainly not when it was a book about running, that I would talk to an astronaut or that I would talk to a Nordic combined skier or a race car driver, but that there were just different directions that endurance took me to. So I would love to write a book where I talk to an even broader group of individuals too, because I love learning about other people's jobs. I love the interview process. I love just sitting down and just following my curiosity and like asking people questions and then finding ways to turn their answers into serviceable tips for the reader.
I love that part about your book that you flip the concept on its head because you got creative endurance, which is, okay, I'll be talking just to creative people, but your interviews, like I just found a really interesting addition to the whole topic and the structure of the book. Let's talk about interviews. How did you get to reach out? How did you write even a shortlist of who you're going to speak to? And how are you going to reach them? How did you get in contact? Did your editorial contacts help? And how did you do it? And how did you connect interviews? Because with you and I sat on a panel, on a book panel last year at a conference, and I was fascinated. I was like, your first answer was like, I want to turn this into a documentary. And I'm like, fuck, that's a good idea. I should have thought of that. But obviously your interviews, because we have a different style, we do different things. And I was really fascinated by that. So if you can tell us more about the interviews and how did that come about and what did you learn from it? And I know a little bit, but I want to know more.
Sure, 100%. You know, like I interviewed Molly Boz and I interviewed Dean Karnazes, who were two people that I literally just emailed out of the clear blue. And I said, hey, I'm writing a book on creativity. Can I interview you? Whereas I interviewed Jeanette Epps, who's a NASA astronaut, and one of my editorial contacts gave me a contact for NASA's PR, which was like a very surreal moment, you know, in my career, just like emailing with NASA and explaining to them, hey, I'm writing a book on creativity and I want to talk to one of your astronauts. And they're like, how, what? And I'm like, I promise I'm not trying to get any kinds of like trade secrets. I'm not a spy or anything like that. Because I was like, listen, being an astronaut is like a dream job, like for all of us when we were kids. And I interviewed a 9-year-old and he was just like somebody around the block for me who just draws a lot. And I was like, it would be really fun to interview a 9-year-old. And then at the very end of the process, I met this really cool 76-year-old at a coffee shop. And that felt like the bookend moment, because I'm like, okay, well, now I'm speaking to the concept of endurance by showing just like a whole spectrum of time, right? I think part of it was just like, I was just fire hose creativity moment where I want to talk to a race car driver, right? I want to, you know, I've got a runner, I've got a skier, I want a cyclist in the book now. Oh, I want a story about somebody who swims. So I was just like, I wanted to get a little bit of everything in the book. It's a skill that I think from creating packages in the editorial world, and, you know, we always try to create like these well-rounded packages that can speak to a wide variety of audiences, that I started to think in that mode where, like, okay, let me just, like, I need all these different types of people, because that was like when I was really thinking about creating a book that was more universal, right? And like giving a little bit of something to everybody. So not just giving something to like my students, but what about somebody out there who's 55 years old and is an insurance sales agent or something like that? Like, how can I give them just like one little story that would fascinate them? So basically, it's just like I was following my curiosity, emailing people nonstop. I think I have 39 different interviews in the book. I probably emailed and pitched to twice that many people. Some people didn't get back to me. Some people are just like, no, thank you. But yeah, it was a really fun journey just to like search for people, and just, you start to learn how you can be creative in different ways. And just, the internet's an amazing place, and you can just talk to a lot of people and a lot of types of people.
I think, what was the most surprising thing you've learned for the interviews? What was, like, because I love the diversity, and to even think about, I'm going to interview an astronaut. That's fantastic. But what have you learned? What was the most surprising thing? They're like, it seems so obvious.
I think that the thing I learned, and I think the thing that changed me fundamentally, was like, I would go into an interview thinking, okay, this is what I want to get out of the person. This is the information I need. I want to talk to this person about how to deal with revisions or whatever. And 5-10 minutes into the conversation, I'd be like, oh, we're not talking about revisions. What they're talking about is just so much more interesting, right? So as an example, when I talked to Billy DeMong, who is an Olympic gold medalist, his event was Nordic combined skiing. And when we first got on the call, he was like flush. And I was like, you look flush. What's going on? He's like, oh, I just finished a 3-hour workout. And he explained to me how he was on the treadmill and he was just running on the treadmill. And I was like, how do you run on the treadmill for 3 hours? That just sounds ridiculous. And he said, I just put a post-it note with a dot drawn in the middle of the post-it note, and I put it on the wall and I stare at the dot and I just clear my mind. And that became this whole bit that I wrote in the book about focus. And I can't remember what I went in there with the plan for, but I was like, this story is just so out there that I have to write about this. And it was like a liberating moment where I was like, okay, I'm interested in this. And if I'm going to write about this in a way that reflects my interest and my enthusiasm for the topic, ideally I get the reader interested in it. And it was also just a lot of fun to draw these connections and say, okay, how do I turn this story about this guy running on the treadmill for 3 hours, right? And he had so many other great stories that I tried to work into the book, but I was like, this one story that was totally unplanned, like, it has to go in there. So it was like, you're a musician, like jazz, I guess. And I can't play music, but it's like, you're improvising. Whereas, and something that like, I may not have been as good at years ago as a designer, because as a designer, it's like, you know, we're kind of obsessed with like structure and designing editorial. It's like, I create the look for these packages and be like, okay, it has to fit into this grid and has to be this word count. And it was like, okay, well, if I want a really good, satisfying book, I have to know like when to zig and when to zag and just go with the flow of things. So I just learned that if somebody has a good story for you, when you interview them, you go with that.
I'm fascinated by the dot on the post-it note. I'm absolutely fascinated. It reminds me of the book by Flea from Chili Peppers. He was describing someone who was literally playing the same note, same strum for hours. They were thinking, he's a bit mad, right? And then they realized, that's like a master of Zen. Like, if you can do that for hours and still like just focus on that, like a master meditation, it's just like, how do you do that? Like, because we think that stuff just seems wrong, because when you think about it, we wake up every morning and we just sort of, it feels like we just jump on a highway and just go, because everything's so sensory. Like, we don't have so many, like by nature, we got so many like different thoughts and different sensations that we explore. And it just feels like, where do we stop? Because now we have to tell ourselves like how to do this stuff, because you described it as you learning, and so you're taking bit by bit, because when we start in the industry, when we start, when something smells and tastes good, you're like, I want to learn everything now. I want to do most of it now. And you don't necessarily think about how am I doing it? It's just, you're just doing it because like, it feels incredible. Whereas you think that you need all 8 hours a day or 10 hours a day. Whereas when you grow older, you go like, I'm happy with 2 hours because I'm spending 6 hours thinking about this. Because it's just like we learn through the edits, like I call it like the funnel of output, and you sprinkle everything inside and just you thinking, okay, what am I going to do? How am I going to do it? What's the concept I'm going to make first, second, third? You're going to try it. Whereas when you've tried it already in your past, you know that you don't have to do 7 different concepts because you know that one, you can finesse it. You can actually spend more time on it. And I think that's, again, the endurance thinking that you can just like, actually, I can push back because it's going to work. It's going to be fine. And we can then focus on just that one thing alone. So you mentioned adding your second skill, so your second title as an author. How did you find your sort of written word next to your design skills? Because I've been mentioning pretty much, I think, on every episode of this podcast that I could never understand people who went from design into writing when I was at the beginning of my career, 10 hours a day in Photoshop. I was like, why do people write books? They were great, but you need to be almost like a completely different person. Whereas what you said earlier, like you can change your career as often as you want. And I'm a firm believer that you don't have to have a linear career. You don't have to be like, start at the bottom and be the CEO and then retire and just drop dead. Because we can do these amazing things, you know, like that's pretty much how our ancestors, you know, our predecessors pretty much like work. They're like, you know, you work in a factory, you know, die in a factory, you know, pretty much. So I think it's liberating because we can actually learn so much more from one another. And the democratization of information is just, we can do amazing things every day if you're willing to do it. So you and written word, how did your environment inspire you? How did you find it? And did it start at the comics time? Did you know, were you writing already then? Or did you think about concepts? Was it something that you have to learn?
I think that the earliest memory I have of actually enjoying writing was in college. I liked art history classes, believe it or not. I always loved compare and contrast essays that we would have to do because it was like, oh, okay, like this could be a really boring assignment or this could be a fun assignment if I just try to compare and contrast like two paintings that like totally don't feel like they're similar. Right. And convince my teacher that they are similar. I wouldn't say I was the best writer back then, but I do remember like moments when teachers would say, hey, you're good at writing. So like, as if you can't tell already, like I do really well with encouragement and when people like say, pay me a compliment. And it's something also like I'm trying to like give other people compliments because it's my way of paying it forward, because those little compliments, as you can see, go a long way. And you may not realize that like younger me was trying to be a writer. So when a teacher says, hey, you're pretty good at writing, like, that's going to stick with me for decades and decades. So, you know, it started there. And I think that throughout the years, I had to write little bits, you know, maybe like for award submissions and share with like my editor in chiefs at my jobs. And it's funny because they would be like, oh, you're pretty good at writing, Mike. And it was like, it was always kind of like, oh, like it was, they were surprised, like, hey, designer could write. So I think that like building on that confidence, it was just like, okay, let me try to write this book. My style of writing for Creative Endurance evolved a lot over the course of time. I really don't feel like I got it until the very end, because I must have rewritten it like 7 or 8 times, because I was like, I designed it so I could like just go back in the text and like I would rewrite it over and over and over and over until I felt like, okay, this now sounds like a friendly creative coach. I eventually was like, okay, I know that the tone that I want this book to take. And I was reading a lot while working on the book too. And I remember reading like Stephen King's book on writing, and he would talk about like the ideal reader. And then like, I started to think more and more about somebody who's in their mid-20s, some young designers that I know, and thinking, okay, if I'm speaking directly to them, how do I keep them engaged? The very early version of the book, like it was like, I wrote it in like second person, and it was like Tony Robbins. I was like, I want to write a book that's like a wacky Tony Robbins kind of book, where like it sounds like the narrator's like yelling at you. But then like my editor was like, we'll give you a lot of creative freedom, but not this.
Did you, with the tone of voice, like how you project yourself, because of you said you rewrote it quite a few times, did you ever feel like you didn't know how it should sound? Like, you know, that happens with a creative process, with a visual creative process, that you never know, am I a creative chameleon? Am I borrowing from a style, from a trend? Am I borrowing from preset ideas? Because personally, I had a massive crisis about year and something ago when I was writing my two books, I didn't know what I wanted to do because I wanted to write my book on creativity for sale, like a comedy, like, hey, this is fun. This happens. This is going to be this. And the more and more notes I wrote was like, this is depressing. Literally, like, no, there's so much stuff that you try to tell people to avoid and how, like, okay, this was a battle. This shouldn't happen. I shouldn't write on this client. Shouldn't have said yes to this. And you kind of write, okay, we're learning from this. We should be trying to tell people, let's make it upbeat. And every book attached when I was writing threw me completely, of course. I started reading the Subtle Art of Not Giving a Fuck, which is like brash and happy. And I was like, oh, let's write it really funny. And then I read Jimmy Carr's book, which is, I think, one of the best books on creativity. It's, if you know the English comedian Jimmy Carr. And I was so like thrown, confused. And I realized, well, you've written four books before. Why don't you just write them in the same way? Because they worked. What are you trying to do? And you're thinking, I think there's a reminder. It doesn't matter how far you've gone and what you've done. And like, just be yourself. It feels so hard to accept it and to do it because I remember opening a paperback by Jeffrey Shaw, which is like the self-employed life. It's a beefy, beefy paperback with words and words. And I'm like, I'll never do that. Like, I can't, because I was like, and then we had too many words. Like, we could have written three paperbacks, you know, just like, oh shit, because to borrow a quote from another Chili Pepper, it just, the drummer chats me and says, the most interesting shit happens at the end. Once you oil your wheels, once you get going, then you get started. That was the reason why I did two books, because it was like, we're going to get going. It wasn't as easy, but how, with your self-editing, let's talk about, I mean, again, there's an endurance. Like, if you say you've rewritten things seven times, how much of an input of an editor did you have, and how much of work, how much did you do on your own, and how did you do it?
I did not really know what I wanted the voice to be in the beginning. Like, I'd be lying if I said I did. The thing I knew that was like, I would eventually get it. You know, the feeling I was chasing was like, when I get it, I'll know it. And it was kind of like, it was a gut reaction. Like, I know when this is right, when it's right. So I just rewrote it over and over. And I knew, like, towards the end, I was like, I don't know if this is going to be good or not. But then when it surfaced, I was like, okay, here it is. My editor gave me a lot of creative freedom, which is really nice. But it was also like a little scary, especially for my first one. So one thing that I found that worked for me was like, I shared it in different iterations or different stages with people, like designers that I know, creatives that I know. And it was funny because a lot of times, as soon as I shared it with them, I was like, okay, I know what's wrong with the book. And it's too late for me to pull it back from them. But it was like, because there was something for me about once it goes out there, like it's now a product and I start to think about it more of a product and I kind of get out of my head and think, okay, I know what needs to be right. The other thing that I found that worked for me was like, I would force myself to just put it aside and not look at it, not read it for 2 weeks. And I think part of the benefit of designing and writing the book was like, I could just turn my eye towards designing for a bit. Cause like you mentioned like all these like books that are like long and verbose, and I love books like that. I can't write a book like that either. And I actually designed a version of this book before I wrote it, because that's what got me excited for it. And I was like, oh, I can see it. I was like a bit of like positive visualization. Like, I could see this book. Now I want to fill those pages with words. So I had like my design on one side, and then I had a Google Doc that I would work on the other side, because I couldn't do both. So I would just write in the Google Doc and then pour it into my layouts and then see that the text was like three times longer than it should be. And one of the goals for me was like, I just wanted it to be a really good, fast-paced experience, because I thought like, okay, well, the idea is endurance, the book should move quickly. And I wanted to kind of function like Aesop's Fables, where you get a little bit of a story, but you get to the moral of the story quickly. So I was thinking a lot about like density of information. And I really wanted the book to be dense with tips and to, you know, to give stories that would make the tips memorable, because I think tips on their own are just whatever, but just to give like good stories along with it too. And I think that once I got it into layout and once I started to cut it down and see it shorter, and I started to see it come together. And you mentioned like finding your voice or leaning into your voice. I would think a lot about I would draw parallels between me as a writer and me as a designer. And one thing that I've experienced like with every Fast Company cover is like, you know, because I try to design every cover so it looks totally different. And like I said earlier, like as a designer in my earlier years, I was obsessed with structure. And now at Fast Company, I try to make a look of the covers by not having a look. But that's really hard because I can't lean on a template or anything like that. A lot of times I'll pull a design reference and I'll think, oh, I want to design like this, or I want to design like that. And my head starts spinning when I just say like, screw it. And I don't look at any of that stuff. And I just sit down and design the way I want to design. That's when it comes together. There's a parallel there between what you're saying about writing. And I felt the same thing where it's just like, okay, let me stop trying to write whoever I just read last week or whatever. Let me just try to be myself. And that's when I just felt like it all flowed and came together.
I think you're a brave man for designing it first and then writing it and then doing two things at the same time, because your book is beautifully designed. It's very much a nod to your obviously editorial work. And it feels like, for me looking at it from England, it seems like it's very American. It just feels like how it's done. And that's great because it's nice to see something that's not the number one off, you know? I think when I see the paperbacks, I'm always scared of like just the sheer volume of words. It's just like, how do you make it palatable? How do you make it digestible? How do you actually get, because I have spoken in my publishing career so far, I've spoken to lots of designers, and surprisingly, not many of them are fast readers or even heavy readers. You know, they're not engaged readers. It's just that's a nugget of wisdom. Okay, what can I get? How little note do I need to read to actually get this? And how can I move on? And it's just, it's getting that research and getting that information from people, like how do you create products that are more engaging than regular paperback? But how do you not make them over design like a heavy magazine story? So I love that you've kind of turned the concept on its head and we're like, you know what, we're going to have sort of a hybrid, which I'm a big fan of hybrid, like everything that sort of makes me think differently, like music, which is a fusion of, you know, jazz and death metal or whatever. And it's always, oh, you made me surprised. You made me feel something, because that's ultimately what we're trying to get from people. You know, we want to make some people feel. So I salute you for the design and that, because yes, you start where it makes sense, because if you feel like you've hit a dead end, there's nothing worse than carrying on. You're not going to do it whilst you're on the run, like you're running a dead end. Like, well, that's it. Let's go back out and see what, you know, what other perspective we can get. And with the wording, obviously trimming it down, that's masterfulness of its own. Like going, what can we do to not overload people? With the rewrites, did it go through edit afterwards? Like, did you send it off and did you get something different back, or did you produce the final version?
I mean, I did all the rewriting. The editor, in an early draft, he told me to not curse so much.
Fair play.
He said, don't curse if you don't have to curse. And I think I remember when I showed my dad an early version of it, he told me the same thing. He said, don't curse. So
what were you cursing?
I like to throw an occasional fuck or shit or whatever, just like for emphasis. I think a well-placed curse is like really powerful, because one of my goals for this was like to be honest. It was something that I had discovered when I gave that presentation, was like, I didn't want to just talk about a bunch of work and say, oh, this is great, because that's not relatable. So to be relatable, like you got to talk about the hard shit that somebody went through to accomplish something, right? So yes, I took out the cursing, but I kept all of the honesty in, and that was really important to me. So yeah, I shared with friends, you know, I shared with friends that are editors, I shared with friends that were not editors. People gave me really valuable feedback. It was so interesting to me to see like different people take away from writing. And I think now, even though like they say you're not supposed to read the reviews or whatever, like I've been reading the Amazon reviews and just fascinating to see like what people like. Some people say, hey, the layout's really annoying. Some people say, hey, the layout's really good. Some people say the tips are good. Some people say the tips are fine. Whatever. You realize not everyone is going to be happy. And when you accept the fact that like not everyone's going to be happy, like it's a lot, hell of a lot easier, right? And that's not to say that you should only make it for yourself. Like we were talking about like musicians, some musicians earlier, like you should think about it as a product for other people. But if you put yourself in the mode of I have to make everybody happy, you're going to drive yourself to the drink. So like I had to step away from that mindset. But I found that I really enjoyed the process of sharing it with a lot of other people and getting their take on it. And it kind of became this social experiment for me, where like I was just connecting with people I hadn't talked to for years, whether it was like, hey, can you read this? Or, hey, do you have a contact at NASA? Or, like that part was really fun for me. I enjoyed the whole process. I mean, there were nights when I was like ticked off, and especially when I was like, I don't know what the hell this should sound like. Or when I had to cut my own copy down by like 33%. But for the most part, it was a fun process.
I have to say that unfortunately, you've entered a world of reviews, and
yes,
oh my words, from personal experience, it's bewildering sometimes, because you feel like the more you try to help people only to get like a really nonsensical review, you're like, you have not read the title, you've clearly not read the book, you've read a few chapters, it doesn't make sense. And then you say, okay, well, how do you make yourself feel believe better? And I looked up actually today on Goodreads before we spoke, I was looking at some books which are very successful, sold a lot of copies, like Still Like an Artist. And on Goodreads, people are like more cutthroat than anywhere else. And they're like, Goodreads has got about 32,000 one and two star reviews. Of course, it's got like 270,000 reviews, but that's 30,000 reviews. Imagine if you're like, when you're not ready, or when you're like, when you think about, I might take everything personally. That's a lot of people who think that your book is shit. But the book is not shit. It's just not for them. Because if you want to speak to everyone, you're talking to no one. And it's just like double niching to people. Because ultimately, if you get one person to say, you know what, Mike, you've changed my life. Like, I have actually taken something from this. That's what it is. For your personal experiences, I'm sure when you go back and think about the Marvel comics, you know, that you used to buy like a $10 note, they changed you, how you felt and what you did. Of course, there were people who thought, oh, these comics are shit. This is garbage. Like, why do people make it? What's this about? And it's just that realization that that's what we need to learn, because ultimately we're looking for gratification from our creative process because we feel it should work all the time for everyone. Like, look, this is great, but not everyone buys Nike trainers. Not everyone wears Adidas. Not everyone likes Kanye. People still listen to Kanye. And we tell ourselves, like, we don't want that creativity in conflict. We want this to be a smooth path. Whereas we learn from the stuff, you know, we learn. And you find yourself, like, the more you try to help people, the more you will annoy people who will be annoyed by anything. But you will find that we will hit the people that actually need to speak to. They will take your advice. And that will be more worthwhile. So, yeah, I think Seth Godin said that he hasn't read Amazon review for the last 12 years or something because he's got nothing to learn from it. Like, fuck it, I don't care. You know, like, it's out there, whatever. And with the medium of books, you can sneakily change and edit. You know, you can improve layout. And you can see that which designers printed their first book because they got type against the gutter. And it's just that you learn from the process, but that's what makes it more enjoyable. Then I always say one bad review is not going to derail a good product, and one good review is never going to make a bad product a good thing. So it's just, it's the yin and yang. But yeah, if there's one thing, don't worry about the reviews, because every book on the planet is littered with absolute idiots going, poof, what's this? Tolkien, I don't believe nothing. What he's doing. Fascinating. Thank you for the insights. How long did it take you from start to finish, from that sort of encouragement to the finished product?
I would say it was about like 14 months. Yeah. It was a pretty, like all things considered, it was a pretty quick process. I would say I got a book deal within 3 months. I had another 3-4 months to write the full thing. And then, but then, you know, I continued to write it or rewrite it as I designed it. And I really have to like give my publisher a high five because like they allowed me to continue to rewrite it and tweak it. And I'm sure I drove them mad, but I was like, the ideas are hitting me. I'm going with it. And I also just made it so I'm like, if you give me any changes, I will turn the changes around like very quickly. Like I just made it so I'm like, I'm ideally the easiest person to work with because you asked me to change something or tweak something. They really were very reasonable with their changes. It was more like shifting it and making sure it was like broad enough for a wide range of consumers. And I think like I work best with that too, is like where you, if somebody gives me some feedback on a design or a piece of writing and they keep it broad enough where like, okay, I can tell me the base problem and I'll solve it. And I think that if being a designer, you know, turned writer, it's a really valuable skill that I've learned from designing, is just like how to respond to feedback, how to think about an audience. It's like kind of goes to what you were saying about Amazon people and like some people trashing the book, but it's not for them. And it's thinking about, okay, who's my target audience, right? Because not everyone's going to like every design that I do either, but you have to think about your target audience. Otherwise, like you're just creating this like very vanilla piece of work. So yeah, like I found that like responding to feedback from my editors was what helped propel me to actually like create something that was usable for an audience.
Before I let you go, I need to know about a cover design, because obviously you produced these most amazing covers for Fast Company. And it was nice to meet you a few months ago because I'm a fan of Fast Company. I've been linking articles in my newsletters for forever. And it was nice to meet you because I really appreciate the work that you put into it. When you talk about the covers, when you talked about the magazines just earlier, you said you tried to make them different. And the recent cover with Marcus was one of the another amazing ones. When it comes to book covers, how many book covers did you go for? Because from my experience, I say, especially working with musicians on their album covers, unless you've got 27 options, you haven't tried hard enough. You know, you haven't explored, like you haven't tried hard. And with my personal experience working on my covers, even though we had the idea, it still took a year to finalize what we wanted to do. How was it for you, for someone who makes covers on a monthly basis, to do a cover for your book? What was that? Was there a fight or was it easy?
It wasn't easy. There wasn't a fight, but I think it was an unexpected challenge because I was like, oh, like the cover is going to be the easiest part. I think maybe I went into it like patting myself on the back thinking like, oh, I've done a bunch of magazine covers, like book covers are, they're like the cousin of magazine. So I'm like, this will be easy. It was not easy because I had a lot of versions with like illustrations on the cover at first and like very kind of conceptual illustrations, like somebody running inside of somebody's head and stuff like that. And I think it was just like too much. And I was really, really trying to like not do a type cover. Like as much as I love type, but I think it was like part of me was like trying to like buck what I thought maybe some people would expect me to do because I love type so much. People just say, oh, Mike's going to do a type cover. So part of it was just like me making it hard for myself because I was just like fighting. I want illustration on the cover. At the same time, we were playing around with the name of the book. While I was fighting that, I was like, I do not want to change the name of the book. It was one thing that I was like I would dig my heels about because I was like, it has to be Creative Endurance. Because I was like, I wrapped the whole conceit around it. And if the name of the book was Creative Resilience, right? Like having an astronaut and a race car driver in an ultramarathoner doesn't quite click, right? So it's funny how we can just hang our hat on like one little idea. I was like, at the same time, I designed probably about 100 different versions of the cover. And then also designing versions with different names too. Because I was just like, you want more? You want more? I'll give you more. And then I did find that once we came to the final cover, when I saw it and printed it out and trimmed it, because of course I print out every single cover that I made, I was like, oh, that's it. That's the cover.
I wanted to ask you how we validate it, because I normally just make a literally thumbnail and make a screenshot of Amazon and just try to move it around. And I was looking at category because it's always going to be seen these small. And you're like, what gives? Big type, small type, illustration, what would you do? Like, and honestly, you look at that sort of philosophy. And I'm thinking from a, like, from a series perspective, like, you never finish with just one book, and you know, the series will go on. Like, I never thought about it that way from the beginning because I thought I was one and done if at the beginning. And people said, another one? I'm like, maybe. And my first cover took literally 10 minutes because it was a piece of existing work. And it just worked. It just clicked. Job was done. Whereas I think with the latest two books, we tried 5 different illustrators. We tried different things. And sometimes I feel like you have an idea today. You set on the idea. You work on it. And the universe will catch up. Be like, hey, we've done 500 other options with similar stuff. You know, like illustration, especially with characters, is very popular right now. And we had digital illustrator doing other things before. So like, things are moving fast and they grow in a volume until they just stop. And then something new is coming and we just grow a different trend. So did you actually print every of those 100 covers?
Yeah, I wouldn't say I trimmed them all. I think like the ones where I was like, oh, this one's like good, I'll trim this. Did I share all of 100 covers like with the publisher? No, like it was like, I don't want to share something that I think isn't good. You know, when you're designing, you got to just like get out the bad pancakes, right? Like you just making crappy pancakes until you make the good golden brown ones that you're going to share with your publisher or your client or whoever. So I didn't share them all, but I used Miro, which is like a whiteboarding app. And I just would put all of my covers and all of my page designs on Miro in lieu of having a bunch of printouts all around my office and everywhere, because like my wife would kill me if like I had the book all over the house. But like, yeah, I would use Miro and just dump everything I had on there. And it was the same with like writing. I found there was a lot of value in like designing it quickly, putting it there, and then just not looking at it, stepping away from it. And then coming back to it a couple of days, and I'm able to look at it objectively and say, oh, like that's good or that's shit or whatever. So the cover was unexpectedly tricky, but looking back, I'm like, it's fine. It is what it is.
I like that you said it was unexpectedly tricky. Now I think when we tell ourselves issues is meant to be easy, it's going to be okay, we always fall on our face. Like, no, what were you expecting? Because I think Don't be pre-assured, because what makes presenting client work, like, hey, I think this is going to slap. This is going to be good. And they go like, what are you doing? This doesn't work at all. So I think I never put stuff around the house, but I normally get, when we sort of settle on the cover, I get the printers to make a dummy, which is like a book with blank pages. So you see like the weight and the size and the feel. And we sit with there and we start to use this sort of like early promo. And yeah, when my wife says, what's that? Oh, that's good. You know, it's like when you got that sort of that outside perspective. And sometimes when she says, you shouldn't do that, I'm like, okay, I still do that, you know. But yeah, I think everything you describe, I think you couldn't have named a book better, because everything you're doing and the process you've described, it's all about endurance, is actually sticking with the idea, seeing it through. So it's amazing to see the link between your comics and holding yourself accountable to doing it through all that way. It's fantastic. And I'm so happy for you that you've made a book. It's out there. It looks fantastic. Everyone should get it. And it's, as I said, it's kind of like an outline, a category, because it does the same thing, which wants you to be better, do better, you know, grow and learn and work on yourself. But you've shaken it up and you've done a fantastic job. So I'll be the first person to say, what's the second book? I guess there's not a running philosophy, but it's, I think, something on that. You've got something there. And Mike, this is the encouragement. So you've got to make it now.
Yeah, I know. No, I know. I feel the encouragement happening. Again, I would love to write something that's about creating, designing your most creative life, something like that, demystifying creative success. I would love to now challenge myself to write in longer form, not like I'm going to write a novel or anything like that, but write with a mix of lengths. Like, creative endurance is very much about short, digestible bits. And I want to have that, but I also would love to write longer pieces too. Write longer profiles about creatives. I've been taking writing classes too. So I've, like, in my break in between books, because I feel like a second book is inevitable, because I feel like now that I know the process, I want to try it again. I'm taking writing classes and just like little 6-week classes. I've taken a class in like nonfiction writing and dialogue and character and plot. And I'm kind of like, this is like my time now to be a student and to learn more about writing and getting charged up to jump into the second one at some point.
You can tell you from the perspective of endurance, I think it took me like 7.5 years before it all started making sense. It was like, oh, now it all makes sense. And, you know, the longer, but I think that's just the key of life. The longer we do it, the more it makes sense. You might not be as sometimes as excited or as energetic about it. You do make the right moves. You just basically, you pounce once and you do it right. And I think, as I'm always full of quotes, I think it's Obama's quote who said, you know what? I'm not as fast as I used to be. I'm not, it's a rehash of a quote, but I know what I'm doing. I'm not going maybe as fast, but I know exactly where I'm going. And that's the key, you know, like, you don't have to muck about and be silly about things. So Mike, thanks for coming on. So nice to talk. Nice to see you again and talk to you. And as I said, I'm looking forward to what you're going to do next, because this is the beginning. This is only the first one, is the beginning. And yeah, thanks for coming on.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Creativity for Sale podcast. The show was produced and presented by me, Radek Marnich. Editing and audio production was masterfully done by Neil Mackay from 7 Million Bikes Podcasts. Theme music was written and produced by Robert Summerfield. If you enjoyed this episode and would like to support the podcast, please subscribe and leave a rating or review. To get your own action plan on how to start and grow a life-changing creative business, you can get a copy of Creativity for Sale book via the links in show notes. As always, keep those creators' fires burning, and until next time, I'm Radek Marnich, your guide through this exploration of passion, creativity, innovation, and the boundless potential within us all.